This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Globally, nearly 271,000 people have died from COVID-19, and there's been more than 3.9 million confirmed infections. Approximately 77,000 people in the U.S. have died from the virus, and there are nearly 1.3 million confirmed cases. The U.S. Department of Labor says an additional 3.2 million Americans filed for unemployment benefits last week, taking the total to more than 33.5 million since the start of the shutdowns intended to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The number of laid-off workers receiving aid is now equal to 15.5% of the workforce eligible for unemployment benefits. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman on Thursday responded to a series of criticisms from U.S. politicians over COVID-19, including that of the Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, citing contradictions in the U.S. government's actions. In response to some who accused China of delays and cover-ups, which led to the spread, Hua Chunying, the spokeswoman with the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said Thursday that reports from U.S. health organizations have already proven otherwise. Hua also raised the question of how the U.S. is treating its own whistleblowers when its politicians frequently attack China's handling of whistleblowers like former naval ship captain Brett Crozier, who was fired for allowing his concerns about a COVID outbreak on his ship to go public. The foreign ministry spokeswoman urged the U.S. to stop the blame game as the U.S. people's lives are at risk and take real actions to safeguard the people's health. Earlier Thursday, Mike Pompeo said that the U.S. intelligence community is still figuring out precisely where the coronavirus began and that China continues to deny access and be opaque. This is VOA News. Despite mounting pressure to stop using police to enforce social distancing, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio is continuing to stand by the controversial practice, saying Thursday that we're not going to sideline the NYPD. One newly surfaced video of social distancing enforcement gone wrong in New York City showed a police officer tackling a black man for mouthing off. Another showed an officer punching a man in the head as he laid pinned to a sidewalk, unable to fight back. Police watchdogs say the video suggests officers are using social distancing during the coronavirus pandemic as a pretext to harass people of color along the lines of stop and frisk, a practice curtailed in recent years in which officers stop people on the streets and search them for weapons based on their color. It's widely discussed that smartphone technology can play a crucial role in enabling countries across the world to get back to a normal way of life. In Europe, a coalition is forming around the best approach in using its trace infections. Its backers hope it will help reopen borders without unleashing a second wave of the pandemic, but not all countries agree on how best to handle the personal data that's collected. The UK and France think people should trust their health authorities to hold such information on a central computer server. A loose coalition of other nations that include Switzerland, Germany, and Italy are not so sure. They believe data should be kept only on the handsets so that it's impossible for governments to spy on their citizens. The U.S. Justice Department says it is dropping the criminal case against President Donald Trump's first national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Prosecutors have maintained for years that Flynn lied to the FBI in 2017 about his talks with Russia's ambassador, and the retired three-star general himself admitted as much in pleading guilty. But the Justice Department says it's abandoning the case after receiving the facts, and while the decision could energize Trump supporters who've adopted Flynn as a cause, it will also add to Democratic complaints that Attorney General William Barr is too loyal to the president. According to a document published by the Washington Post on Thursday, members of Venezuela's opposition in October negotiated a $213 million deal with a small Florida security company to invade the country and overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. Venezuelan authorities this week arrested more than a dozen people, including Americans who work for the company Silvercore USA, as part of a bungled incursion that has served as a public relations victory for Maduro's struggling government. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, May 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ECOWAS says it did not order a consignment of the alleged Madagascar COVID-19 medicine.
We have not seen the scientific research that has gone into this Madagascar organic herbal preparation that would make us come out and say to our community that this is something that can be used.
Partisan food aid distribution is emerging across Southern Africa during COVID-19. COVID-19 discrimination against migrants is threatening public health and the global economy. South African writers say all books are essential during COVID-19 lockdown. And Malawi's president chooses a running mate ahead of the July 2nd election.
Indeed, the president has chosen Tupere Muluzi to be the running mate, and it is important for Malawi for a number of reasons. Number one is that it demonstrates the president's leadership skills.
Ben Piri is the director of elections for Malawi's ruling Democratic Progressive Party. And measles are on the rise in the Central African Republic. Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley's post, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. West African States ECOWAS has disassociated itself from claims that the region has ordered a consignment of COVID organics or CVO medicine from Madagascar. Professor Stanley Okolo, Director General of the West Africa Health Organization and organ of ECOWAS, says the COVID organics medicine from Madagascar has not been scientifically proven. This comes as a number of African countries, including Liberia, Guinea-Bissau, and Tanzania, say they have ordered the purported Madagascar cure in the name of finding an African cure to the COVID-19 pandemic. Professor Okolo says ECOWAS is committed to promoting national traditional medicines, but only those that have shown to be scientifically proven.
First is to say categorically no. We have not endorsed the Madagascar COVID organics, I think that's what it's called, CVO, nor have we imported it or approved it in our region.
Is your reason for disassociating yourself from the use of this alleged treatment political or medical?
The West Africa Health Organization, which is the health institution of ECOWAS, is a scientific organization. It's an organization that operates in terms of producing and providing expert advice to our heads of states. And so the reason why we have not done so is because we have not seen the scientific research that has gone into this Madagascar organic herbal preparation that would make us therefore come out and say to our community that this is something that can be used. Because it is vitally important to know that when we recommend something, then we're recommending it from evidence.
We have reports that some ECOWAS member countries, such as Guinea-Bissau and Liberia, have ordered and taken delivery of this herbal treatment from Madagascar. What do you say to those who argue that the so-called Madagascar herbal treatment is an African solution? After all, they say Africa is tired of depending on the West for solutions every time there is a pandemic in Africa.
Let me just, first of all, categorically say to you that we believe in traditional medicine. We promote traditional medicine. We have identified, nurtured, and actually continue to promote and sponsor, to some degree supported, centers of excellence in traditional medicine across the West Africa region. And in fact, one of those centers of excellence that we have supported previously is researching on some medicinal plants that we think may be active against COVID-19, but it needs scientific investigation. So to answer your question, this is absolutely nothing to do with politics. It is rather to do with scientific investigation and scientific inquiry. And what we're saying is that, yes, we believe in African solutions to African problems, and we are absolutely very keen to understand how some of these plants work and some of these medicines, and we will be prepared to use some of our sensors in terms of if it was something that people wanted to do, we will be prepared to ensure that the
rigorous research has gone into. But at the moment, as I speak to you, we have not seen the evidence of the research. I have heard that he has cured two people. And for us in the medical field and in the health profession, we need evidence before we can support a cure.
Professor Stanley Okolo is the Director General of the West Africa Health Organization, an organ of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. He was speaking with us from Abuja, Nigeria. Amnesty International says as Southern Africa has been battling the coronavirus pandemic, patterns of partisan food aid distribution are emerging across the region. In Zimbabwe, where millions of people were already facing food insecurity, the rights group says the most vulnerable have been affected. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
In Zimbabwe, lockdowns triggered by the coronavirus pandemic and shuttered markets have made it hard for people to work or find food. Millions are dependent on the government for sustenance. In a report published this week, rights group Amnesty International said some are being denied food because they do not belong to the ruling ZANU-PF party. One such person who wished to be identified only as Peter lives in Mrewa, about 100 kilometers east of Harare. He told VOA that opposition members in his rural community are being treated as second-class citizens. It is really tough here, said Peter, who looks after seven people affected by the lockdown. Local leaders here are from ZANU-PF party and say anyone who belongs to any other party does not get food aid. They say we must get it from the parties we support, even if our names are on the list of deserving people, he says, they are skipped. Robert Chivambo, Amnesty International spokesman in Southern Africa, says this pattern of partisan food distribution is emerging across the region ever since the coronavirus pandemic arrived.
Anyone who does not have the means to make a living must be provided with food regardless of their perceived political affiliation. The distribution of food aid along party political lines is completely unacceptable, and it is undermining the protection measures that governments have committed to implement to uphold the right to food for everyone.
Chivambu says that in Zimbabwe, the weakest are suffering the most.
In Zimbabwe, partisan food distribution has affected those groups in the most vulnerable and marginalized situation, including older persons, child-headed families, pregnant women, and those with disabilities.
Even before the lockdowns in Zimbabwe, more than 4.3 million people urgently needed assistance because of the ailing economy and recurring droughts, according to the UN's World Food Programme. Energy Mutodi, Zimbabwe's junior minister of information, dismissed the Amnesty International report.
No, those are falsehoods. We disagree with totality with those allegations. We are giving food aid to every citizen who is deserving. We have had red flags raised about people who are suffering because of the lockdown, who cannot afford to put food on the table. The Minister of Social Welfare has invited such people to approach its offices, and this has been helped indiscriminately.
South Africa and Angola are also mentioned in the Amnesty International report as countries where authorities are distributing food aid on partisan lines. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Books are back on the market as South Africa slightly eases its lockdown restrictions to allow the sale of educational items. Booksellers in the nation's literary capital, Johannesburg, intend to interpret all books, including thrillers, fantasy, and romance novels, as educational items. VOA's Anita Powell catches up with a prominent Johannesburg bookseller and a few South African writers who explain why they believe all books matter.
For bookseller and writer Griffin Shea, South Africa's 35-day total lockdown made for a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad month. Just a week before the lockdown started in late March, he was putting the finishing touches on his downtown Johannesburg store, Bridge Books, which specializes in African literature. Then, everything shut down. Sales plunged 90%. The entire industry suffered. Two major South African magazine publishers went out of business in recent weeks. Now, as South Africa begins to slowly ease the lockdown, books of educational value are allowed for sale. Most booksellers are taking a very liberal view of that because, as a recent open letter signed by thousands of prominent South African writers and intellectuals argues, all books have educational value. Shay agrees.
So under this level four restriction, we're supposed to only be selling educational books, which is not defined. But for example, at my son's school, they don't have set reading anymore. They go in and propose what they want to read to the teacher, and the teacher approves it. So basically that means we need to be able to sell all novels and all poetry and all long-form nonfiction if we're going to let people read what they need.
Shay says he's had no problems from the police since he relaunched internet sales this week. Actually, he says a few officers have stopped by his store, checked on his hygiene measures, and then bought books. This reporter, who is an avid reader, also took the opportunity to immediately order a stack of volumes for delivery, including a novel by talented South African writer Ivan Vladislavich. He teaches creative writing at a local university and was one of the letter's more than 3,300 signatories. Vladislavich.
For me, the book is still the most vital carrier of the human story in all of its complexity and diversity. And I think it's very important in these times when people are separated from one another physically and societies are under extreme stress. I think that the windows that books open onto the world become even more important.
Vladislavich says books have been essential to his lockdown experience. He says he's recently been immersed in a gripping new dystopian novel by prize-winning South African author Barbara Adair. But why actual printed books? Writer and activist Eleanor Sisulu runs the Puku Children's Literature Foundation and notes that in highly unequal South Africa, physical bound books are still vital and should be widely available.
Yeah, physical books are important because some people don't have electricity, they don't have data. They can't share easily. We've got older people who don't have the Kindle or Kobo or Apple. So I don't think it's an either or. I think there must be a space for both. I love my Kindle. I mean, my Kindle is like a person. If I lose my Kindle, I get distraught. So it's important to me, but I think the physical books are just as important.
Griffith Shea says he hopes that this 35-day book drought might even inspire bigger change in South Africa, like elimination of sales tax on books. In his view, they are essential goods, just as much as food and clothing. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, May 8th. The International Organization for Migration says growing discrimination against migrants who often are blamed for spreading the coronavirus is impeding efforts to tackle the pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The coronavirus pandemic has dealt a serious blow to global migration. The International Organization for Migration reports work visas for migrants have practically come to a halt. And the resettlement of refugees and asylum seekers in third countries has been temporarily suspended. It says thousands of migrants are stranded in Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America because of border closures and travel restrictions. It says many migrants who want to return to countries of origin because of the pandemic are blocked and forced to live in difficult conditions with minimal care. IOM Director General Antonio Vitorino says migrants in countries of destination too often are denied access to health care. He says this puts them in danger of becoming infected with the virus, and it also endangers public health.
At the current moment, we are confronted with the fear, the reluctance, and the difficulty of access of migrants to health care. It's not just a question of fundamental rights. It's also the question of public health, of guaranteeing that access to health care by migrants is in the interest of the entire community.
IOM reports there are 272 million international migrants in the world. They provide an important source of income to many of the world's most impoverished countries. Vitorino says the pandemic will have a powerful impact on the global economic recession that lies ahead and on the subsequent recovery. He says the economic recession will lead to a dramatic drop in the remittances that migrants send back to their countries of origin.
The World Bank forecasts a drop in remittances to Africa during the current year of 30%, which means $20 billion will not be transferred to sustain the livelihood and the households of the families that stayed in the countries of origin.
In some countries, Vitorino says remittances amount up to 15% of their gross domestic product. He says migrants provide essential services to countries of destination. For example, he says migrants comprise 40% of healthcare workers in countries such as Britain, the United States, and Canada. He notes migrant seasonal workers are essential in harvesting a nation's agricultural crop. Despite the key role they play in a nation's economy, he says migrants usually do not benefit from the public safety nets of the countries in which they have settled. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Malawian President Arthur Peter Mutharika has chosen Atupile Muluzi, son of former President Bakili Muluzi, as his running mate ahead of the upcoming July presidential election rerun. The young Muluzi is leader of the opposition United Democratic Front, UDF party, which recently entered into an alliance with the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP. Ben Piri, the director of elections for the ruling DPP, tells viewers Peter Clotty that the choice of Atupile Muluzi would significantly boost President Mutharika's re-election chances.
Indeed, the president has chosen Atupele Muluzi to be the running mate, and it is important for Malawi for a number of reasons. Number one is that it demonstrates the president's leadership skills. He knows and understands talent identification. Honorable Atupele Muluzi is a man with huge ambitions. He's a man who has got leadership qualities. And certainly, in as far as the youth is concerned in Malawi, you can't get a better candidate than that.
Do you think this new team is capable of defeating incumbent president Dr. Salos Chilime's alliance with Dr. Lazarus Chakwera of the MCP that many people are saying is the biggest alliance and the biggest threat to the president re-election chances?
Probably, let me give you a bit of a background to this country. Number one is that since the formation of the Democratic Progressive Party, we have had a number of elections, to be precise, three of them. And in these three elections, DPP has won all of them. And again, this is not the first grand alliance that has ever happened. In fact, you may be interested to note that the biggest ever alliance was between Malawi Congress Party and UDF. That really shook the nation, and everybody thought that that was the end of DPP. Alas, we're still in government. Our adrenaline, our blood is nothing other than winning elections. When it comes to presidential elections, none wins it better than DPP.
Political analysts in Malawi tell me that the alliance between the UDF, Atupele Muluzi's party, and the DPP, President Mutharika's party, did not create the necessary buzz that will enable the president to win re-election. They said that the popularity of DPP is low and that Atupele Muluzi couldn't even garner enough support from his stronghold, which is similar to the stronghold of the DPP. And that is why they think that your opponent will win in the July election. What are your thoughts?
Much as I respect them as political analysts, but let me bring you to attention that most of the football commentators have never played football, not even a quarter of a game of 90 minutes. All they know is to give live commentary, take them to the pitch. There is nothing that they're going to do. I can assure you that none of those political analysts, the so-called political analyst, has ever practiced politics in Malawi. So they better leave politics to us politicians to analyze and make proper judgment.
Ben Piri is director of election for Malawi's ruling Democratic Progressive Party. He was speaking with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. The largest measles epidemic in more than two decades is hitting Central African Republic right now, as health workers are worried that the COVID-19 pandemic is overshadowing pressing needs in the country. Sarah Vulestek, food coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in the Central African Republic field office, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the outbreak.
For the measles epidemics, what you generally see is you see in the health centers, you see a lot of the cases coming out being either suspected or confirmed measles cases. What is definitely always important to note is the rate of deaths in the community or at the health center or hospital level. So, for example, for the emergency team in Carr, we did an investigation following reports in the west of the country in a place called Babwa, and we found that there was a significant rate of community deaths following the numbers that we were being told of the measles cases that were there, and seeing about a 15% mortality rate of the cases that were being reported.
You mentioned this is the biggest epidemic of measles, this is the biggest outbreak in the last 20 years. What could be some of the reasons, and are vaccination rates going down because of the current COVID pandemic?
The difficulty in places like Carr, of course, is that the health infrastructure following the conflict that has been in the country for such an extended period of time, together with its economic situation and the poverty, it's in a decline.
That was Sarah Vulestek, field coordinator for Doctors Without Borders in the Central African Republic. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from the capital, Bangui. Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports in Kenya, where Athletics Kenya has so far helped pay quarantine expenses and transport back home for five athletes who had arrived from India and Malaysia. Immediately, the international flights were suspended. Athletics Kenya president Jackson Tuwei disclosed that they might be facing challenges, including knowing how many athletes are stranded in foreign countries, but are liaising with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to help. Tuwei said they are also in touch with several Kenyan embassies in India, Malaysia, and China, among others, to know the number of athletes held up in these countries owing to coronavirus lockdown. Staying in Kenya, the Kenyan Premier League has written to Confederation of African Football protesting the conclusion of the top tier by Football Kenyan Federation. The federation decided to end the KPL on April 30th, citing the letter by CAF dated April 26th as the main reason. In that letter, the African Football Governing Body had asked FKF to communicate the way on how the season will be ended, whether through annulment or completion. All remaining games of the season were cancelled last week by the Football Kenya Federation due to the pandemic, with Gor Mahia declared champions and representing the country in the African Champions League next season, something which has not gone down well with the league management. In South Africa, the South Africa Football Association president, Danny Jordan, says fans, football officials and players may have to wait a little longer until the atmosphere is absolutely safe enough for football matches to resume in South Africa. Danny Jordan is keen on getting domestic football started before international engagement following the suspension due to the COVID-19 pandemic, and has confirmed that they have suggested to the Premier Soccer League in South Africa, the South African government and FIFA on a likely date of commencement.
And so we have to wait until we get to a position where a reasonably safe environment can be provided. You know, we always said the player's health is first. Football is part of the entertainment industry. And in the entertainment industry, players must be medically and physically fit and healthy.
In Ghana, former Black Stars coach Kwesi Appiah is demanding $185,000 as unpaid 5-month salary arrears from the Ghana Football Association, plus a bonus for matches won. Kwesi Appiah's second stint, which lasted 2.5 years, ended in December. The 59-year-old has now written to the Ghana Football Federation through his lawyers demanding the full payment of the debt, but the GFA believes the payment is not theirs to make, but that of the government. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clouty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butty in Washington, wishing you will have a very good weekend.